The first time I spoke to Father Roy on the phone, he was going to jail. So I said, Father Roy, where do I write to you? And he gave me this address of a jail cell. And that has never happened to me before. That the first time I speak to someone, they're going to jail. And so I thought, I said to him, well, Father Roy, what did you do? And he said, well, I was just demonstrating in front of Fort Benning. And that got me a 6-month sentence. And he had just come out of jail recently from an 18-month sentence. So Father Roy spent 4 years out of the last year, out of the last 8 years in jail. And this is someone who is willing to pay for his beliefs. But again, when I spoke to him after he had got out of jail after 6 months, and I interviewed him, there was no bitterness in his voice at all. There was no bitterness against anyone. And he said to me, you know, jail is a quiet place. It's a place for reflection. It's a place to meditate, to think deeply about the problems of the world. So let me present to you Father Roy Bourgeois.
Thank you very much. Good evening. I want to thank first Asad for really a lot of the hard work that went into bringing this evening together, along with the sponsoring organizations. And also, I really want to thank the three brothers for their fine presentations on Guatemala and Chiapas and Colombia. The School of the Americas, as they said so well, is very, very involved in these countries and 18 other countries in Latin America. The School of the Americas today has more soldiers from Chiapas and Colombia. They are the biggest clients at the school today. Asad did say it very well at the beginning. This is not an issue that's restricted to the United States. While this school of assassins is operating full force on U.S. soil, this is an international issue. This issue is about justice. This issue is about men with guns. It's about violence. It's about suffering and death. And we must address that wherever we are. As we gather this evening, in the United States, there are 6 SOA prisoners of conscience in federal prisons around the country doing between 14 months and 2 years, 3 women and 3 men, very good friends. And I dedicate my talk to them this evening and very conscious of their presence with us. The issue, the School of the Americas, it's serious. It's about suffering. It's about men with guns. It's about oppression. About a school in the United States that brings to this school every year hundreds of soldiers from 18 countries in Latin America to be taught combat skills. And so many of these graduates have returned to their home countries. And they have killed, they have tortured, they have raped, they have disappeared countless numbers of our sisters and brothers in their countries. The starting point of this issue, however, is not this school at Fort Benning, Georgia. The starting point is Latin America and that reality under which our sisters and brothers live there, the vast majority. Struggling for survival, struggling for food for the table, struggling for just wages for their labor, for adequate housing, for schools for their children, for health care, and so many dying before their time. And it's out of that reality of struggle and suffering and poverty and oppression that will come their soldiers to this school in the United States to learn how to be commandos, to learn psychological warfare and counterinsurgency techniques. I think it goes without saying that as people of goodwill, as people of faith, we're called to be peacemakers in our world, to be healers, to try to relieve some of this suffering that's so alive in our world and countries like Latin America and other developing countries. And who are the victims of our country's foreign policy there? Growing up in a small town in Louisiana, we didn't talk much about peace and justice. Went to the state university to study geology, hoping to get rich in the oil fields of South America one day. Out of college, Vietnam is on. Became a naval officer, thought of making the military a career. In my fourth year in the military, being a patriotic young man, I actually volunteered for shore duty in Vietnam, believing our leaders that we had to go there to fight communism, they said. Vietnam was a turning point in my life, and for many of us who were there, young men that we were changed by the violence there, the suffering, the death, losing close friends, being wounded when I was there. I was forced to ask questions in my life I had never asked before, forced to look at my faith more seriously. Near the base where I was stationed was an orphanage, and this elderly priest, Father Lucien Olivier from Canada, caring for these 300 children. And I would go there to do volunteer work. And I was very moved by what I saw. They were peacemakers. They stood out in the midst of all of this violence. They were healers. And I saw them and simply said, what a wonderful way to spend one's life. I began to think about missionary work as a vocation and talked to an army chaplain about doing my missionary work, and he recommended the Maryknoll Order. And I said, Mary who? I had never heard of the Maryknoll community, a group working in some 28 countries around the world. Leaving Vietnam, I entered the seminary and after a few years was ordained a Catholic priest and assigned to our missions in Bolivia, a slum on the outskirts of La Paz, became my home for the next 5 years. It was here that I, as a North American, was taught by the people I went to serve. The poor became my teachers. They taught me about my country's foreign policy. There we were, the United States, supporting a brutal dictator, General Hugo Banzer, who had come into power through a violent coup. They taught me about the CIA, so active in Bolivia and other countries, especially in Chile. It taught me about the multinational corporations in Latin America, exploiting the cheap labor and those resources where there are huge profits to be made. Most of all, they taught me about their struggle, a struggle for justice, a struggle for liberation against all of that poverty. It was there that I was introduced to a new theology, the theology of liberation, that gives hope to the poor. The poor for so long taught a very cruel, a very colonial theology. To accept their suffering as God's will. To be silent and look forward to the next life where their joy would come. How cruel to blame all of that on God. Today the poor know better. As they gather in their comunidades, their base, their faith communities, to read and reflect on the scriptures and other sources, And they come to realize something very important, that this loving God, this Creator, does not want them to suffer, but rather wants to liberate themselves from that suffering and oppression. And today they know that the central issue is greed, militarism, the corporations and countries coming into their countries to exploit them. They know that the central issue is irresponsible stewardship of those resources put there for everyone to share, and where there's more than enough resources for everyone to live comfortably. And they are saying, basta, enough. We are not going to sit back in silence and take this. And our sisters and brothers are empowered, and they are inviting us who know about their struggle, who are citizens of other countries who are exploiting their countries, and asking us to walk in solidarity with them. It was in my fifth year in Bolivia that I was among a group arrested and was forced out of the country and could not return. Not long after returning to the United States, I became very involved with many people in El Salvador. Archbishop Oscar Romero, March 1980, gunned down at the altar for his defense of the poor. That same year, four U.S. church women were raped and killed by Salvadoran soldiers. Two of them were friends in the Marino community, Maura Clark and Edith Ford. And with them was an Ursuline nun, Dorothy Kazel and Jean Donovan. When that happened, many of us began to ask what was going on in El Salvador. Many of us went there. We found, of course, what the four women found. This small country, a microcosm of Latin America, where a small elite had over time confiscated most of the land in their hands, who now had the power and the wealth, but most important had the men with the guns on their side to protect their land and their power and their wealth. And when we went there, we saw our country giving the guns to those soldiers doing the killing. And that was wrong. That was a crime against humanity. And we came home and we spoke out against that. And when 525 soldiers from El Salvador arrived at Fort Benning to begin training in combat skills, I canceled a whole lot of talks in colleges and went down to Columbus, Georgia, home of Fort Benning, rented a little house called it Casa Romero, and began to organize. Friends joined me. Our first meeting, we had 5 people. The next meeting, 10. And our little community grew within a short while. And after 3 months, we felt it was time to take the message to the Salvadorans on Fort Benning. 3 of us, Larry Rosebaum, an oblate priest who had worked with the poor in Brazil, Linda Ventimiglia and myself, we went down to this army surplus place, Ranger Joe's, and we bought army uniforms, dressed as high-ranking army officers. We went on to Fort Benning at night, carrying with us this very powerful boombox that contained the last sermon of Archbishop Oscar Romero that he gave in the cathedral the day before he was assassinated, where he made this special plea to the men in the military to stop the killing, to lay down their arms, to disobey their superiors telling them to kill, and to obey a higher law, that law that says, thou shalt not kill. We were able to penetrate this high security area, got saluted. It was one, I must say, we were shaking. We were very, very scared. went near the barracks, and with tree climbers, we scaled this tall pine tree. And about 30 feet up the tree, we secured the boom box, and we waited. And when the last lights went out, we said, "Bishop Romero, this is for you, brother." And his voice just boomed into the barracks. And I have to say, it was one of those sacred moments that come along in the struggle. Those young soldiers hearing the voice of this prophet, this martyr, coming out of the barracks, not being able to see us under the cover of the darkness there. The instructors also came out with their guns, M16s, threatened to shoot us down, and it was time to come down. We left the boom box up there, however, with the voice of Romero continuing to boom into the barracks. They handcuffed us, kicked us, punched us around, and then took us to the county jail, and then later to trial, charged with criminal trespassing and impersonating army officers. Went before this well-known segregationist judge, Judge Robert Elliott, well known for sending Martin Luther King to prison during the civil rights movement, did not like protesters. He gave us the maximum, 18 months, and sent us to federal prisons. Prison was hard, but we learned something very important early on, that they could send us to prison, but they could not silence us, that the truth cannot be silenced, that we will speak from prison, and when we get out of prison, we're going back to work. And we got out of prison in good shape, Linda, Larry, and I. Joined the voices of so many in the United States and many in Canada, trying to stop that military aid to El Salvador, which got up to $1 million a day, and the bloodshed continued. November the 16th, 1989, front pages of your newspapers here in Toronto and around the world, another massacre. Six Jesuit priests, their co-worker, a young mother, and her 15-year-old daughter, Selena, dragged out of their rooms at the university in San Salvador in the middle of the night and massacred. A U.S. congressional task force went to El Salvador to investigate and reported that those responsible for this massacre of the two women and the six Jesuits were trained at the U.S. Army School of the Americas at Fort Benning, Georgia. At this time, I was working out of our Marino Center in Minneapolis, and it was time to break camp and head back to Georgia to investigate this School of the Americas. I was able to find a little apartment right outside of the main gate, called it the SOA Watch, and began to invite friends to join me. And we went to work. Our first action was a very serious water-only fast, camping out at the main gate. 10 of us. Kathy Kelly from Chicago, working a lot today on the Iraqi issue. A Jesuit from Boston. 2 Salvadorans. Charlie Litke, who got the Medal of Honor in Vietnam. Couple of Dominican priests. We fasted for 38 days at the main gate. Our bodies grew weak, but our spirit was strong. After ending our fast, food never tasted so good. Got our strength back and went to work. We had to start gathering documentation about this school. We know so little about it. It had been hiding behind this tall wall of secrecy for so many years here in the United States and Canada. In Latin America, well known as the School of Assassins, La Escuela de Golpes. through the Freedom of Information Act and human rights reports coming out of Latin America, we began to piece together what this school was about. A school that began in Panama way back in the 1940s, a U.S. Army school, training Latin American soldiers in combat. They said back then to bring stability to Latin America. Stability for whom? The corporations, the Rockefellers in those early days. And there, the CIA ensuring that those profits would be protected. Graduates of the school became their country's dictators. General Hugo Banzer from Bolivia, not only a graduate, but in 1988 inducted into the school's Hall of Fame, where today his photograph hangs on a wall with some 22 other generals. General Manuel Noriega from Panama, another graduate. Roberto Dubuisson, the well-known death squad leader from El Salvador. Colonel Julio Roberto Alpidez from Guatemala, responsible for the death of the husband of Jennifer Harberry. And the list goes on and on. In 1984, the school was forced out of Panama and very quietly settled in the pines of Fort Benning, Georgia, where today it's operating full force, training about 1,000 soldiers every year from Latin America. This is not some sort of a human rights academy as the Army would like to present it. This is a school known for its graduates for returning to their home countries to defend that socioeconomic system that has kept the rich rich and the poor poor. The targets, first the poor, and those who dare to work with the poor or defend their rights. Labor leaders, university students and professors, church leaders, human rights advocates, healthcare workers, they have been those who have been the targets of these soldiers trained at this school. We didn't realize how serious this issue was until 1993, when the United Nations Truth Commission report on El Salvador was made public. They cited those high-profile cases and those responsible. We learned that in the case of Archbishop Romero, his assassination, the three responsible, two of them trained at the school. The rape and murder of the four church women, of the five responsible, three of them trained at that school. In the case of the six Jesuits and the two women, of the 26 responsible, 19 of them SOA graduates. El Masote, over 900 men, women, and children killed in El Salvador. Of the 12 officers responsible, 10 of them trained at the school. But it wasn't only El Salvador. Whenever we had massacres, human rights abuses reported in Honduras, Guatemala, Colombia, Peru, there was a connection to this school and its graduates. In 1996, we learned when the Pentagon was forced to call a press conference and announce that at the School of the Americas from 1982 and through 1991, there were these manuals, 11 manuals, that were used that advocated torture. And that really stirred up things in Congress. I want to say the first couple of years in Georgia were desert years. It seemed like very few people were paying attention to our research and all of the suffering involved through these graduates. But things began to happen after a couple of years. We knew that people in every country, they're people of goodwill, people of justice, who don't want people to suffer. And sure enough, people began to speak out as they learned about it. The Presbyterian Church, USA, at their annual assembly in Arizona, with its 6 million members representing their faith community, passed a resolution calling for the closing of the school. Right after the Leadership Conference of Women Religious with its 57,000 nuns, and the Veterans for Peace, and then later Amnesty International, NAACP, and other organizations on board. In Congress, there began to be some movement. Joe Kennedy, early on in 1993, introduced a bill calling for the closing of the school. That first vote in the U.S. Congress, 173 to 256, a huge gap. We had a lot of work to be done. And what happened was the grassroots community started to organize. Lots of veterans, church people, college students, high school students, women and men from all walks of life, hearing about this school of assassins, began to get angry and began to write their members of Congress. And then last year, this past September, another vote in Congress, this time 212 to 201, coming within 11 votes. Meanwhile, around the country, things began to happen. Every November, we would gather at the main gate of Fort Benning for our traditional gathering to try and be a voice for those who have been silenced, to remember that young mother and her daughter and the Jesuits and the four churchwomen in Romero and all the other sisters and brothers who have been killed by these graduates down the road. That first anniversary, we had 25 people, and then 125, and then 400. 2 years ago, 2,000 gathered for a vigil. Speakers, music. Speakers from Central America. And then that Sunday, our memorial service, which has become a tradition. 601 of us entered Fort Benning. We crossed that white line that they have drawn across the road, saying to us, if we cross that line and enter Fort Benning, we would be arrested. We would break the law. And we asked, what law are you talking about? There is a higher law. This law which calls us to be in solidarity with those in Latin America. There is this law that says, do not kill. And that is the law we are going to follow this day. And we entered Fort Benning, 601 of us, carrying coffins and those crosses bearing the names of those killed and calling them by name. And after their name was called, presente, that person is present with us today. They arrested us half a mile down the road. In our group, 25 of us were repeat offenders, and they brought us to trial back before Judge Elliott, Maximum Bob. He was waiting for us. In our group of 25, Sister Rita, a 70-year-old nun with three other nuns, a couple of World War II veterans, college students, 11 in our group, grandparents, a couple of college professors who were retired. Sure enough, he gave us the maximum, 6 months in prison. But before the sentencing, we had an opportunity to speak from the heart and let him know how we felt about this. We knew we were going to prison. And we said to him he could send us to prison, but he could not silence us, that we would come back in greater numbers. And he gave us the maximum, 6 months, with a $3,000 fine, which we refused to pay. And we all went to prisons and scattered around the United States. And it was hard. But I want to say we spoke from prison and found meaning in the solitude of that cell. When I went to prison this time, I was angry. I was angry because we were going to prison for such a nonviolent protest. When those... Thank you very much. Thank you. when those who did the killing got amnesty. That's the way it works in Central America and Latin America. The military has so much power. They can do what they have done. They can kill, torture, and rape, and massacre communities, as in Guatemala and El Salvador and other countries. And they can give to themselves amnistia total. Now that's power. And when I arrived at this federal prison in South Carolina, I was angry. And I said to the warden, I was not working. Everyone works in prison. That I would not work until those thugs who did the killing will start doing their time. Well, in prison, there's not a whole lot of dialogue about this. And I was sent to solitary confinement. And you're confined to a small cell, 6x9 cell. They bring you your food. And the days dragged on into the months, and it got hard. But I want to say I found meaning there. I felt solidarity. But there were also, of course, at times those dark nights of the soul, where you question, or you cut off from your friends, your compañeros and compañeras. And you ask those questions that often you ask, that others ask you. How effective are you going to be in what you're doing? We all ask that question. But I want to say penetrating that cell was what I refer to as grace and the wisdom. I got in books there from a lot of the spiritual writers. One of those books coming in by Dorothy Day, this wonderful woman who started all of these soup kitchens and houses of hospitality for the poor. And she said in one of her books, you know, that we're called to be faithful. Let's not worry about being effective. And that meant a lot to me. I found a lot of meaning in that. That we're called to be faithful to what we know in our hearts to be the truth. To be faithful in walking in solidarity with others. To be faithful about healing and being peacemakers in our world. And I felt free. I felt free in that prison cell. And each of us got out of prison in good shape. We had a big reunion. We got out last September, just in time to start organizing for November. Not knowing how many would come to Fort Benning, Georgia this year, this past November, thinking maybe that Judge Elliott might in fact kill our movement with these harsh sentences. But it was not to be. It was not to be. People began to arrive this past November at the main gate of Fort Benning from all over the country. Vans, cars, people in bicycles, college students, veterans, so many. There are also people here from our Romero House and others. Those who were at Fort Benning this past November, could you please stand? Please, there are some in the audience. Those here and others actually drove from Toronto to Georgia. And there we were, 7,000 strong, women and men, young and old, from all over the country, putting our feet before that big sign that said, "Welcome to Fort Benning." We were there to say, we want this school shut down. We want these soldiers to head back home. We want this training and this killing to stop. And we had on that Saturday the vigil, so many speakers, members of the Lakota Nation from South Dakota with their drums. We had the Mayan blessing, sisters and brothers from Guatemala with us. We had Adriana Bartó from Chicago, Guatemalan, whose two children and father were killed in Guatemala. And that Sunday, our memorial service. And after the memorial service, keeping alive the memory of so many, we entered Fort Benning. We crossed that line, not knowing how many would enter. And there started four abreast, the group being led by actor Martin Sheen and Sister Dorothy, Sister Jackie Depker, and others. Four abreast entering Fort Benning, carrying the coffins, the white crosses, the Star of David, the photographs. And we entered, college students, high school students, parents with their children, a mother with a four-month-old child, people in wheelchairs. 2,319 entered. So many that they couldn't arrest that many people. They simply put everyone on buses and took them off of the post and went back for another few hundred and then another few hundred. Let me just say, it was a good day. It was a good day. This is where we are now. This movement has grown. It's strong. It's growing. Hope is strong. There is in the U.S. Congress a new bill just introduced by Representative Joseph Moakley. Joe Kennedy has retired from Congress, has passed on the baton to a good friend, Joe Moakley, who headed that U.S., that congressional task force to investigate the mask of the six Jesuits and the two women. And it's his bill that's just been introduced. Right now we have about 140 co-sponsors. And in the Senate, there's a bill just introduced, a companion bill by Senator Durbin from Illinois. And right now we're working hard to try and get those bills passed this year. Letters, faxes, visits to your to your leader, Axworthy, Mr. Axworthy, Lloyd Axworthy, the Minister of Foreign Affairs, who has a lot of influence, who's in close contact with members of Congress and people like Bill Clinton. So letters, of course, visits to the Minister of Foreign Affairs would be very important, and your other leaders. Let me say this. We need your voices. We need your voices. This movement is strong, but we've learned something very important. We are up against a giant. The Pentagon is fighting very hard to keep this operation going. This school is very, very important to the Pentagon. It's their way of keeping the military in Latin America in power, entrenched, to protect the interest of those multinational corporations in the sweatshops there. And they are going to fight very hard to keep this school going. It defends that system. It keeps it going. But we, people in the United States and people here in Toronto and other parts of Canada, I was just giving talks in Spain. This issue is a big, big issue in Spain. This issue is a big issue in many countries. And I can simply say, we need your energy, we need your voices to join ours in the United States to bring these doors of this school shut forever. Lastly, I feel the message for us is from our brother Archbishop Oscar Romero, who gave his life for the poor, who said before he was assassinated, let those who have a voice speak for the voiceless. You and I, we have a voice. And I just hope that we can speak clearly and boldly on this issue and all these other issues of peace and justice. Thank you.